This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. So a major player in the feedlot space is selling up a few of its big assets. So you may have seen that Morton Co. has listed its Pine Grove and Yarranbrook sites for sale, along with its interest in the future Central Queensland feedlot at Gagango. And that Yarranbrook site, Morton Co. only took over last year. The industry generally this year reached an all-time high, with figures published from Meat and Livestock Australia showing turnoff of grain-fed cattle reached 894,178 head, which in turn led to a record grain-fed export volume. So according to Executive Chairman of Morton Co., Charlie Mort, they made this decision after reviewing their assets earlier this year. He explains to Claudia Sullivan that these were the ones picked for sale as they were the easiest to sell off to return funds to shareholders.
I guess Morton Co. has been operating for a long time, 30 years basically now, and I've had a lot of shareholders throughout the period. It's, everybody's interests and timing's changed, so I guess we're looking at a return of funds to some shareholders or all shareholders in that case. Yeah, so it's just really a bit of a change in direction.
Was it yourself, did you want a change in direction at all? Was it anyone else? Did the Hughes family want a change in direction?
Oh, look, I think it's fair to say, I mean, as a board, we made the decision. But, look, I think we also, you know, it became apparent after reviewing the assets, with Morton Co. has maybe 110 or 15,000 head of cattle on feed. Following the sales of these assets, we're still going to have, I don't know, 85,000, something like that. So it's not like we're still committed in the business, but we're just looking at those options.
Mm. Was it a matter of the business getting too big, you know, just trying to maintain something that you can work with?
Oh, no, not really. Look, it's I think that it was just where we saw the most, probably the easiest assets on a smaller scale to exit, and those, certainly there's been huge interest in those assets. So, I mean, feedlotting's in a very strong position at the moment. The whole of the beef industry is, and we've got a lot of inspections of those assets.
Mm. So. Yeah, are you looking for any particular asking price? Is there a particular asking price in mind?
Oh, obviously, we have expectations in there on price for sure, but there's nothing public there, no.
Mm-hmm. And I guess could this impact the future feedlot, the greenfield site at Gagango at all?
Oh, look, I think the interest that we've had there, the site's, you know, it's a great site. It's got huge opportunities up there. You know, it's the beef capital up there. There's no major feedlots that are available up there for 100-day cattle in a large scale. This will, you know, you'd be able to feed over 40,000 head of cattle up there. It's going to be a great asset, and it'll get built up there for sure over time.
Hmm. I guess the internal review, was it looking at anything in particular?
Look, we had just a review of our assets. That was really it. Mm. And Morton Co., I mean, you need to realise, I mean, as I said, it's been going for 30 years, and we've been building assets all the time, and we just have opted to look at selling these assets at the moment.
Back to your experience with Morton Co., how you've been doing this for almost 30 years. I think it's 28. Is there anything that you want to do, any new business venture you'd like to look at? What's your future look like?
Oh, look, well, Morton Co. still has interest in stock feeds. We've got a trucking business. We've obviously our fertiliser business. So there's a lot of things that we're looking at, and continuing growth on those options.
Morton Co. Executive Chairman Charlie Mort speaking to Claudia Sullivan. Now, keeping with the beef industry, I want to take you to the top end where an interesting deal has been made. So an Indigenous-owned cattle company in the Kimberley region of Western Australia has started producing its own branded beef, which is now being sold in remote communities across the north. The Kimberley Agriculture and Pastoral Company, which is known as CAPCO, runs about 40,000 head of cattle across four stations in the Kimberley, and it has struck a deal to send those stock across the border to an abattoir in the Northern Territory to be processed and packaged. Matt Brand visited the meatworks to check it out.
So I've just stepped out of the Rum Jungle Abattoir on the top end of the Northern Territory, which is really busy today processing cattle that have come from, 1,500 kilometres away. These cattle today have come from the Kimberley region of WA. And it's all part of a really interesting service kill. To learn more about it, I'm here with Alison Dakin from CAPCO in the Kimberley. Tell us what's happening here. How come Kimberley cattle have found themselves at Rum Jungle?
CAPCO had a dream, and part of that was to be able to produce their own protein and sell it back into retail stores, into Aboriginal communities across the Kimberley. So CAPCO is 100% Aboriginal-owned pastoral company, and it was an aspiration of the directors and of the foundation of CAPCO that eventually they'd be able to sell their own meat back into the stores and back into the traditional owners over the lands which it operates. And that is what we have managed to bring to fruition through working with Rum Jungle.
And so, at the moment, roughly how many cattle from your operations are coming to the territory?
We kill 6 decks every 4 weeks, so 144 head every 4 weeks comes over here.
Right, and we've just come out of the abattoir. We've seen that Kimberley beef, that CAPCO beef, getting put into branded packaging. From here, tell us about its next journey.
Yep, so the majority of that branded packaging will go back into retail stores. So we have outlets from Broome, Derby, Fitzroy Crossing, Halls Creek, Kununurra, and even in Darwin. We also have food service customers and restaurants that we sell into right across the Kimberley as well. And then we also have some mining camps and some big commercial customers that we service as well.
So early days, but how is this all going for you?
It's going really well. It's been a huge learning curve. So I've never worked in the red meat industry. I've worked in pastoral operations, yeah, but not the red meat industry. And they are two really different industries, even though they're interlinked. So it is very early days, but it's looking really promising. And we've had a lot of support. We get really good feedback on the meat. So when Greg's drafting the cattle that come into the beef brand, we stick to a particular type and a particular breed of cattle so that we get that consistent flavour, which is what our customers are chasing. So by maintaining that consistency, we've had good, consistent feedback that that we're meeting the mark on what our product's trying to do.
And we're about to meet some of them, but you've brought a big team of young CAPCO workers here today to Rum Jungle in the Northern Territory. Tell us about that idea and what you're hoping.
We brought 12 of our stock camp over, and we think it's really important that they come and see the end result of what they're working towards. So when they're in the yards and you know, using their low stress stock handling, and we can talk till we're blue in the face about why we do this and the impacts at the other end and how it impacts the meat and the eatability and whatnot. But to actually bring them here and show them a carcass that's got a bit of bruising on it or something, and be able to go, look, that's what happens, you know, that's why we need to keep it slow, and that's why we need to, you know, really make sure that we stick to those low stress stock handling processes. And it's really good for them to be able to see. I think they've all loved it from what I've been able to see so far, but it has been all about helping build their education and build their understanding that we are just a small part of a bigger industry, and how proud they should be to be part of the Australian agricultural industry.
G'day, my name is Kerry Kane, and I'm the plant manager of Rum Jungle Meat Exports up in Bachelor.
And I'm out here today to check out some Kimberley cattle that are getting processed here at Rum Jungle. Tell us about the CAPCO service kill and from your point of view.
Well, CAPCO came over with a bit of an idea to come over and do a bit of a service kill. And I forged a relationship with Alison and partner Greg, and we talked we talked before this all happened, and the idea came from an idea. And to look where it is right now, it's fantastic. It's a business that's growing for them. We love having them here. They're part of our family now as well in the jungle. Their business to us has secured us in a way that, hey, that we do a service kill for somebody. We're punching out some product for them, which they display over in the Kimberleys. I know that we've got good feedback, and it's good for ourselves and our business as well. With the group that's coming through today, you can see their smiles and the excitement and the joy that they what they bring over to Rum Jungle. And they produce as well, yeah. It's actually a joy to see, look at those young people over there, hey? And the smiles on their faces, eh? I told them right at the beginning when they were going to leave, they were going to have something special when they walked out, and I hope they have.
I'll better go and chat to some of them. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me here. Cheers.
Hey, how you going? John Skinner from Derby, Western Australia.
Tell us about how you got involved in the cattle industry of the Kimberley.
I started working when I was 14, down in the Gascoyne, and then came back to the Kimberley, and all the boys working in Marada, I knew them, so ended up trying to get a job there at Marada with Ding, called Greg up, and yeah, got a job there at Marada.
And now cattle from that property and others are coming to the Northern Territory and being processed right here at Rum Jungle. You've got a chance to go through that supply chain today. What was it like? What did you learn?
It's good to see how the cattle are processed and cut up and different, how the package and stuff is good.
How did it make you feel to see that Capco brand on all of that beef in the packages?
Pretty good. Never worked for a station that does that, so yeah, it's pretty cool because I don't have much local beef around the Kimberleys, and Capco doing it is good, giving people sort of their own taste of their own beef around the Kimberleys.
I hear the ribs are a bestseller.
Yeah, no, big seller, good, probably good ribs.
Thanks so much for your time on the Country Hour.
All right, thanks you.
Also here from Capco is Ivan Watson. How old are you, Ivan?
21.
21. Tell us about what got you involved in the Kimberley cattle industry.
So I was living where I'm from, so Derby, WA, and had no job, so I decided to go contracting. And from contracting, I joined the camp at Marada, and that was my introduction into Capco.
And today, here in the Northern Territory, seeing your cattle being processed, what was that like?
Oh, it's a great thing to see. Like, you know, we bring them from the bush, and it's good to see where they turn up and how it goes. So it's a great experience.
This is beef that's not getting exported to customers way overseas. This is beef coming back into the Kimberley, into communities. What does that mean to you?
Means a lot. You know, communities are isolated, therefore prices are high. So when these beef go back, the whole idea of it is cheap and affordable meat, great quality, and that's what we want. You know, we want to provide our locals with that.
Thanks so much for your time on the Country Hour.
No worries, thank you.
That was Ivan Watson from the Kimberley Agricultural and Pastoral Company, ending that story from Matt Bran. It is 18 minutes past 12. Up next, the latest on decommissioning renewable energy projects at the end of their life.
Join your local ABC team when the sun rises each weekday. Our team is out in the community. We curate the news, weather and your local rural report. Join us for breakfast right here on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
The Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner has released his expectations for renewable energy infrastructure decommissioning. So he has said that Australia needs a nationally consistent standard to give certainty and clarity around who pays to rehabilitate land. So unlike traditional power stations, which are typically built on land owned by energy companies, most renewable energy projects in Australia are hosted on private land, especially private agricultural land, usually through lease agreements. So Think wind turbines and solar panels, which have a life expectancy between 20 and 40 years. Commissioner Tony Marr says landowners and local and state governments should have watertight confidence the developers will take responsibility for decommissioning. And he says this should be regulated if that's what is needed.
My expectation is very clear, is that this is cleared up, made it absolutely concrete around who's responsible for the end of the life of these energy infrastructure assets, and that the community isn't left holding the baby when these things reach the end of their economic life.
And who should be responsible?
It should be the industry. They're the assets. They own these assets. They have put them on to the countryside, and they should be totally responsible for removing them and rehabilitating the land back to what it was like before the energy infrastructure was there, if that's what the end of the life of those assets mean, and also that's what the landholder wants.
And this is the result of some ongoing conversations, Tony, that you've been having across the country with a range of different groups. You're saying this is my clear position that the energy company should be responsible unless there's an exemption to that. But how do you enforce that? How do you make that happen? What does it look like?
Well, it means that if we need to regulate it, then that definitely needs to happen. If we need to have it clearer in contractual arrangements that landholders enter into with these energy companies, then, you know, that needs to happen. And there is definitely part of that already happening. But my assessment is, having had hundreds of conversations right across the country, is that it's not clear enough, it's not secure enough, and people aren't as confident as what they need to be to make sure that the local community, whether that's councils or whether it's a group of landholders or individual landholders, that there's money in the bottom drawer that no one can touch to make sure that when these things reach the end of their economic life, that there is available appropriate resources to make good and return the landscape to what it was before that infrastructure was placed on there. Again, if that's what the landholder and the community want.
And we're talking about nationally consistent policy or framework. That would be what, legally enforceable?
Well, yes, if that's what's required, it should be a nationally consistent approach, recognising the role of the Commonwealth and the jurisdiction of the states and the role of the energy companies. So, you know, the developers, the operators of these infrastructure assets. So it does have to be a partnership, but it makes sense to me to have a national approach. It makes sense for me to recognise that the states have got, you know, jurisdictions around planning. There's a role for local councils. I mean, these are large pieces of infrastructure. You can't just pull down a turbine blade and put it on the back of the ute and take it to the tip. So we have to actually recognise the role of multiple stakeholders in the story and in the arrangement, but it should be really clear, it should be watertight.
When we think about what's on the landscape at the moment, wind and solar generates about 40% of Australia's electricity or renewable electricity. The federal government believes that Australia is capable of reaching 82% of energy generated by renewable resources by 2030. And there's a range of schemes in place to achieve this. Was it a misstep, do you think, not to think about the rights and protections of the land and the landowner right at the beginning? Are we now in a catch-up phase that was avoidable?
Well, I think a couple of things, Jo. One is that there has been an increased level of activity in the last, you know, X number of years, but certainly it's a much busier space, much more active space in the last, say, decade or so, and that will continue. So my view has always been that we need to keep pace with what's happening in the community. So whether it was a misstep or not, I mean, some people will say that these provisions are already there. You know, some energy companies will say, look, that's clear for us and you know, we take full responsibility. The conversations I've had is that there's not enough confidence in that. There's not enough acceptance of that. So that's why I've sort of made this position statement very clear, is this is what we need to do. If there isn't enough confidence and acceptance that, you know, that the operators, the developers will put appropriate level of resources away at the appropriate time then we need to address that. And that, you know, that's a key part of my role, is to make sure that we get the right balance between what the community expects and what's currently happening in the industry.
Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner Tony Maher speaking to Joe Prendergast. Now, the Commissioner is going to now outline his expectations to governments and energy companies, along with groups like the Clean Energy Council. So I'll bring you more details on this as it comes to light.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app, this is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
If you're looking for a more accurate record of localised rainfall, well, a new app has been designed and it's meant to help producers gain greater insight into rainfall information specific to each property. So it was developed at Federation University and it's called Rainfall Mapper. So how it works is it merges the information from the Weather Bureau's rainfall gauges and radar data, then users can select areas of up to 500 by 500 metres for specific locations and time periods. Creator Dr. Peter Weir is with the university's e-research and digital innovation unit and says the tool will help farmers to make more informed decisions, including crop planning and irrigation strategies.
Traditionally, we measure point-based with rain gauges, so they only represent in the area of rain that they collect is about that of a small dinner plate. By taking this application to merge rainfall with weather radar, we're able to look at a whole area. In this particular case, it's an area of 500 metres by 500 metres. This is already a product that Bureau of Meteorology have been generating for some time. It's called Rainfields 3 and it's publicly available, but it's very hard to interpret the data. It's 15-minute interval data and it's stored on the National Computing Infrastructure Database, so it's not user-friendly at all. So what I have done is turned it into a user-friendly product in the form of this Rainfall Mapper app. What it is able to do is give a spatial indication of the rainfall falling in a chosen area, so the user is able to select an area by a rectangle on the app, and the app is then able to, and between two points in time, so the app then is able to go and look up the amount of rainfall that has actually fallen in that square, if you like.
So what are some of the practical benefits for farmers?
Well, it gives them a much better indication of spatial distribution of moisture on their paddock, because they're looking at all the rain that's fallen in that area. There may be some inaccuracies in the type of measurement, but it's certainly a lot more indicative of what's going on, as been reported by a lot of anecdotal evidence. With a lot of the localised intense thunderstorms we have, particularly or we've experienced in previous years around the Wimmera, they've actually been totally missed by the rain gauges, because the bomb rain gauges are 30 to 50 kilometres apart and the storm cell might only be 30 kilometres across. So in the records that are in the recordings of the gauges just do not indicate what's going on. So what this product is able to do is to infill that rainfall and look at it from a spatial point of view, and that seems to have sparked a lot of interest amongst farmers.
So the Bureau of Meteorology has been under scrutiny, certainly recently, but over a number of years now, farmers are saying that they don't necessarily trust that the information coming out of the Bureau of Meteorology is accurate. So can farmers trust this app?
It has got disclaimers in it that I'm a consumer of the data and not a producer of the data. There are inherent possible inaccuracies in using merged radar and rainfall data. But, of course, it's been approached in a fairly scientific way to generate spatial merged data using selected rain gauges. They don't use all the rain gauges in an area, but that's not my remit. You'd have to speak to the Bureau about that. At the same time, it's very indicative of what's actually happening spatially in the landscape.
If a farmer's interested in searching a certain time period, is that a possibility?
Yes. It depends on the way where the data's been set up. Some of the radars, weather radars, are only around 2 years old, so obviously they can't go back much further than that, but some of them have been around for much longer than that. The data that covers most of the rainfed cropping regions of Australia, something like 70-odd radar units, which we can access the data, they can choose from 24 hours. They can look at, say, a whole season's worth of data for a specified area, but there are constraints on the size of the area at that they choose at the moment. You know, you can't choose half the state. The amount of data you create was just impossible.
It's a bit more specific than that, yeah.
Yeah, looking at it from a paddock point of view, the use that it's been experienced so far, people have found it extremely helpful and interesting to look at what's happened, how much has been accumulated, say, on the paddock, and whether there are wetter areas than others. And that gives them the impetus to go and maybe do some more investigation to see if that is valid.
And to that point, as the weather patterns change and are less predictable, what role does an app like this play?
The more we get these localised intense thunderstorms, the more useful this becomes because, as I mentioned before, the gauges are too far apart to pick up the detail. If you think of a rain gauge as roughly the size of a small dinner plate, that's the only area that is actually being measured. If you take all of the Bureau of Meteorology rain gauges that cover the whole of Australia and work out the area of each one of those, it's equivalent to about the area of a tennis court. So it is very much this problem of taking point measurements in a highly chaotic event, because the rainfall is one of the most challenging meteorological variables to measure or model because of its randomness, especially in these localised thunderstorms, which, you know, the data is only really available on the radar, and then merging it with the rain gauge data helps make it more accurate.
That's Dr. Peter Weir, researcher at Federation University's Centre for E-Research and Digital Innovation, speaking with Jane McNaughton. Randall has texted in about this story and has asked what happens when you have no radar coverage. It's a very interesting question, and I'm not sure how the university would work that because it's comparing the radar information with the rainfall totals. But if you want to take part in that trial, and maybe that's something that you could bring up with the team, you head to the Federation University website and look for the Centre for E-Research and Digital Innovation section. And Dr. Peter Weir is the researcher leading this trial. Weather is up next.
So you're saying I'm stuck here?
Detective Sergeant Mackenzie Clark's back on the ABC. Ex-fiancé or just the challenge?
Impossible.
So you'd think. All new Return to Paradise starts Saturday, November 15 on ABC TV and ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's time to check in on the weather, and Harry Clark joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Harry.
Good afternoon, Megan.
So what are the watch points for this week?
Yeah, so looking at today, we do see continued unsettled weather in the east, has some isolated showers and thunderstorms through eastern districts south around Ingham, probably a little bit more focused in the southeast corner and central Queensland today, so some isolated thunderstorms at the moment between Billawilla and Gladstone, and also out just on the Granite Belt around Stanthorpe and into the Lockie Valley as well. We do expect some activity this afternoon. In terms of those thunderstorms, not expecting them to be severe today, although in the southeast they could contain a little bit of small hail. It's usually very cold air aloft. Otherwise, as we switch our focus further inland, it's quite an opposite pattern, quite cool for this time of year. So temperatures are roughly sort of 3 to 6 degrees below average and quite settled as well. So relatively sunny skies continuing across the interior under a ridge of high pressure today and indeed for the next few days. So looking ahead, we will see that ridge of high pressure really dominate the weather across the state on Tuesday and Wednesday, meaning a chance of a shower really contracts to the coastal districts and the far north, and the chance of thunderstorm just on the peninsula on both Tuesday and Wednesday. So some very dry air coming in with that ridge as well tomorrow and on Wednesday, meaning some cool morning minimums and also a little bit of an increase in our fire danger ratings across much of the state during Tuesday and Wednesday.
So just first off with the rainfall and storms, is there much rain in it?
Look, not a huge amount. They are fairly slow moving, so it'll be a case of feast and famine with those. With some places probably picking up around 20 or 30 millimetres possibly, and most other places receiving nothing. And that was certainly the case in the last 24 hours. We did see some isolated falls to around 80 millimetres, and apologies if I get this name wrong, DAC, which is inland of Rockhampton or northwest of Rockhampton, between Rockhampton and Mackay. And we also saw some isolated falls to around 60 or 70 millimetres in some of the Townsville suburbs as well. Much lighter totals further inland. And that's typically going to be the story again today. Some very isolated hit and miss rainfall with these thunderstorms, but for the most part, fairly light falls, if any.
And you mentioned that cooler weather through the interior. How much cooler will it be, you know, in comparison to averages?
Yes, yeah, so looking at temperatures today across the interior, we do expect those maximum temperatures in particular to be between sort of 2 and even up to 8 degrees below average in the far west. And that means maximum temperatures in the high 20s for much of the southern interior, the low 30s through central and northern districts. So it still feels warm, but certainly not as warm as it's typical for this time of year. And that's thanks to a fairly cool southerly flow that's really quite dominant across inland Queensland today and for the next few days. So looking at minimum temperatures tomorrow, we do see that anomaly once again around sort of 2 to even up to 8 degrees below average tomorrow morning, and some single digit minimums possible across places like Stanthorpe and the Granite Belt. So fairly comfortable sleeping weather at least, but in terms of when our temperatures start to warm up, it will be sort of Thursday onwards as our next trough starts to approach from the west and our wind flow switches to more of a northerly wind flow. So returning some of that warmer, more tropical air and moisture into parts of the interior from Thursday.
Now, speaking of temperatures, this severe heat wave warning for the peninsula area remains in place. Is there any indication when temps will start cooling in that far northern part of the state?
Yeah, certainly very warm over the peninsula today and tomorrow. As we head into the latter part of the week, we do expect to see a fairly big increase in shower and thunderstorm activity. So that will knock those maximum temperatures down from what's currently the high 30s, around 39 in Weipa today, to the mid-30s by around Wednesday. And that will be probably the easing of those heatwave conditions. In saying that, still very humid and hot up there at this time of year. And for the remainder of the state, while we are expecting an increase in heat towards the latter part of the week, once again, we do get a fairly substantial increase in moisture and eventually showers and thunderstorms from a Thursday in parts of the central west and northwest, but more broadly across much of the southern, central and northern interior from Friday and over the weekend. And that will lead to a decrease in temperatures through that sort of latter part of the week and weekend as well. So increasing humidity, sort of decreasing maximum temperatures, probably a bit of an increasing minimum temperature as well as we get towards the weekend for most.
And around coastal parts, what can people expect for the week?
Yeah, so today we do have a southeasterly wind change starting to develop through southeastern waters. So winds are sort of 15 to 20 knots from the southeast for southeast Queensland and central Queensland waters today. Elsewhere across the north and far north, fairly light and variable winds today. But as we get into tomorrow, we do see that ridge of high pressure more firmly build across the Queensland coast. So generally southeasterly winds 10 to 15 knots for most of our coastal waters tomorrow, tending a little bit more northeasterly inshore during the afternoon. And on a Wednesday, we do see that southeasterlies strengthen even further through much of the sort of South Queensland coast, up to 20, even possibly 25 knots. For the Gulf, we do see generally sort of southeasterly winds up to 20 knots for the Southern Gulf and more like 10 to 15 knots for the Northern Gulf for the next few days.
And just before I let you go as well, you mentioned I think tomorrow and Wednesday there'll be an increase in high fire dangers. Are there particular parts of the state?
Yeah, look, it's pretty broad in terms of our increase in fire danger ratings the next few days. So really anywhere through the interior is likely to see high fire dangers. Tuesday and Wednesday, and even possibly some locally extreme fire dangers around the Gulf Country, just due to the fact it's a bit warmer up there and a little bit of a fresh southerly as well. So basically all our inland districts will be at high for the next few days with this very dry air remaining in place. Some of our dew points, which is a good measure of humidity, sitting down towards sort of minus 10 or even minus 15 degrees by Wednesday through the interior. So very, very dry air mass coming. In saying that, we do see that really moderate as we go towards the end of the week. Still likely to be some high fire danger ratings around, but really peaking through the middle of this week.
Harry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Harry Clark, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. Now, speaking of those high fire dangers, as of today, local fire bans remain in place for 7 council areas across parts of North Queensland today. During fire bans, you are not allowed to light any fires in the open, but there are some exceptions. For more details about what you can and can't do during a fire ban and a full list of the council areas that have bans in place today, head to the Queensland Fire Department website, which is fire.qld.gov.au. That's fire.qld.gov.au.
The Ashes. And the cricket on.
Rushes in and bowls a yorker and bowls him.
ABC Sports Summer of Cricket on your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Thank you for your company today. And if you want to join the conversation on the Country Hour, you can shoot me a text on 0487 993 222. Well, a natural resource management group in southern Queensland has been awarded $9 million in funding from the state government for land, soil, water and biodiversity projects. So Southern Queensland Landscapes received the funding for 2 projects, and it's aiming to improve grazing land along key waterways and protect koala movement through southwestern parts of the state. CEO of the organisation, Gillian Meppin, tells Madeline McCosker they're looking for expressions of interest from local landholders to complete the work.
So Southern Queensland Landscapes has had 2 projects funded underneath the Natural Resource Management Expansion Program. So the Department for Natural Resources, Minister Last, announced this week that our 2 projects are a go.
And can you tell me a little bit about those projects? There's $9 million altogether that's going to go to 2 separate projects. So tell me about those.
Yeah, the first one is a program that's designed to work with landholders to undertake better grazing management, mostly in the protection of, entirely in the protection of prioritised waterways, and mostly through the use of strategic fencing and improved stock watering points. So noting that waterways are often the most fragile part of any paddock, working with landholders to find ways we can fence off waterways and undertake grazing management practices that ensure that we protect those waterways in a strategic way. The other program of work is with our koala habitats. So Southern Queensland has got some very strong and well-known populations of koalas, but some of those habitats are threatened, and they're primarily threatened by feral pests, wild dogs, in invasive cactus species primarily. So we're really keen to work with landholders to about with those habitats and make sure that they are the best places they can be for those koala populations. There's also a part of that project that supports greater genetic diversity. So that's understanding the diversity that's within those populations and protecting the strong populations that are there.
Interesting, and obviously very exciting to be receiving that money to help with these projects. And you mentioned in terms of the project that you're working on with landholders, there's $6.6 million set aside for that, and that's focusing on 124,500 hectares. As you said, that's going to be focusing on fencing and water points. So what specific work are you going to be doing with that money, and I guess what are the key outcomes that you're looking for there?
So we're looking to protect those key waterway areas, and whenever we undertake project work at Southern Queensland Landscape, we do it in a very strategic way. So we look across the whole of Southern Queensland and we map the region for areas where we can have most impact. In an ideal world, there'd be unlimited dollars for the environment. Of course, there is not. And we're very grateful for the department in terms of the money it has allocated to this program. So we work strategically through mapping to understand where the priority areas are, where we can invest to have most impact. We seek landholder expressions of interest based on those priority areas, using them as a guide. And if you jump onto our website, if landholders jump onto our website, they will see their priority maps. Really encourage them to connect with the Southern Queensland Landscapes team to have a conversation and understand if their land, their property falls within that area and how we might partner together to undertake that project, in particular the riparian fencing work. The koala project, same. We have a priority map on there that shows where the known koala habitats are, and we've already got a number of expressions of interest. Landholders where we know they've put their hand up and said, yes, we have populations, please assist us with protecting those habitats. But it will be the conversation that landholders have with the Southern Queensland Landscapes team that helps them understand how we might partner in those projects. So the waterway protection through grazing management program is, as you said, $6.6 million. And then there's been $2.5 million allocated to the improvement of priority koala habitats.
I'm interested to talk a little bit more about that, because there's a few areas specifically mentioned in this release. Quilpie, Upper Bulloo, Upper Warrego, Aidavale, Yulo and Lavelle areas. And it specifically mentions removing key threats like wild dogs. So is that money going towards pest management and eradication procedures there? Or, you know, what sort of ways are you looking at protecting those koalas?
There's some, our current projects already have a lot of pest management embedded within them. So we have a number of projects across Southern Queensland where we partner with landholders and with councils, particularly in pest eradication work. And this will be similar in the sense that we target areas where we know there is a high level of threat to a species, in this case, koala. The use of aerial shooting or whatever might be required in this instance, there could be a number of ways that we undertake that pest management, and that'll depend on the local area. We're not prescriptive in that. That's why we partner with landholders. Landholders know their area very well. Everything has to start with a conversation about what they are seeing and understand of their landscape and how best to approach so we achieve those outcomes of protecting, in this case, koala habitat. The areas that we've mentioned there, there's quite a few in Western Queensland. There's also areas in the eastern edge of Southern Queensland's region. There is an area mentioned there that's around the Millmerran district. We know there's koala habitats there, but there's also quite a few along the Condamine. Not rocket science to understand that koalas congregate around waterways and in river environments. We're having a beautiful season at the moment, so there's some pretty healthy tree species that koalas are happy in across the landscape. But rivers are the places that we see them primarily. So looking across the landscape for those strong, healthy populations and then working with landholders to protect the ground, really, so they can get from tree to tree. It's horrible when you see a picture of a koala that's disabled through harissa cactus or any cactus species for that matter, and that's moving, stopping that movement from tree to tree through, you know, whether it's predation by dogs or a cactus species is something that we're keen to address.
CEO of Southern Queensland Landscapes, Gillian Meppin, speaking with Madeline McCosker. Now, these types of projects are becoming more popular with landholders across the country doing things that improve environmental outcomes or biodiversity on farm. For hundreds of years, land has been cleared to make way for crops and grazing paddocks. But in what's become a bit of a generational shift, more farmers are looking to replant and restore vegetation to bring back nature and make their land resilient to natural disasters. Emily Middleton has this report.
I'm walking through fairly dense bushland on Tim and Ash Wright's property in Yugowra on the Lachlan River. Just 20 years ago, this area was almost completely bare. It had been stripped back for cropping and grazing. But now, as I look around, it's full of native vegetation. Plenty of eucalypt and acacia trees and shrubs, plants that were hand-planted by Tim and Ash, and also ones that have sprung up by themselves. Tim Wright told me about the work they've been doing to rejuvenate the property, which is on top of a hill and quite windy.
So we're in a tributary of the Lachlan River. It's an ephemeral stream. We're on either side of a creek that drains a small valley on the western slopes of Nangar National Park. It's a bit of a link between the landscapes of the Nangar vegetation and the Canimbla vegetation in the two national park blocks. I've been involved post-Yugara flood along with my family, my wife Ash and sister Liz, with the Yugara catchment land care. So what we're trying to do here is just understand how changes to the riparian zones or the flow lines of our farming landscape, how it can impact on those big floods that we sort of see. And the 2022 flood really brought our level of awareness right to the front of our minds, and we're sort of trying to do what we can without affecting too much our farming profitability to try to stabilise our whole landscape.
So can you tell me what a riparian line is?
So we've got creeks that have typically over the last 100 years have been cleared. They've usually been the last water source in the landscape, so the farmers have they've been denuded of most of their native vegetation. They really get big chunks of water flowing down them in times of floods, and so a lot of siltation, a lot of scouring of those areas happens, and they become really unstable and they cause big flows in a hurry. And so we're trying to put some grass and trees and shrubs and forbs back on them, and trying to build that into the whole context of future requirements for farms to be areas where ecology and biodiversity and carbon area dominant areas can survive.
Can you just explain to me, I suppose, in simple terms, why is native vegetation on these areas necessary when previously it was cleared?
It saves our fences. It keeps our nutrient on our farms. So we still graze these areas. We can't graze them as much as we used to. We don't put up as many fences because the vegetation slows the flow of water up. We're getting siltation, so we're catching other nutrients from up in the catchment, and so it's improving our fertility. We don't see it straight away, and this is the problem. The whole problem is it takes so long. We're standing here in projects that are 20 or 30 years old and only just seeing changes that ecologists can talk about now.
Rejuvenating farmland has become increasingly popular in recent years as farmers look to better soil health and environmental resilience. Botanical consultant from Arcane Botanica, Dan Clark, has seen this push firsthand and is on the ground teaching farmers about what native vegetation thrives well in their area.
It's a local land services promoted gathering where we are sort of promoting the conservation of nature for farmers and what they can do in terms of increasing biodiversity values on their property. My role here today is to give some guidance on plant identification, especially eucalypts. Farmers normally want to know about that, what they can do in terms of planting and enhancing habitat. We're sort of looking at all those things and answering those sort of questions today. Sort of a thrust to reverse the trend of history where we don't have to clear anything anymore. We're sort of trying to put back what's been lost.
And so why is that important for farmers?
I think farmers want to be seen as protecting nature rather than sort of maybe copping flak for destroying it all the time. I think there's some generational shift there to a recognition that biodiversity worldwide is in a bit of strife and a bit of decline. And I think the farmers want to be on the front foot and setting the example for protecting habitat on their properties, and that realisation that of what they've got on their properties in terms of fauna using the land. and just protecting it for future generations. I really think there's a big shift back towards the conservation side of things, which might have been there centuries ago, but sort of got lost in, I would say, the sort of post-World War II era in a big way.
And I've heard that you're the expert in acacias and eucalypts. They're some common plants on a lot of people's properties. I guess, how can they benefit people's programs on their farms?
Well, we have different eucalyptus assemblages across the landscape, and they're defined by vegetation communities, or what sort of vegetation assemblage you've got across your landscape. It's important in terms of planting and rehabilitation, so you want to plant eucalypts that are adapted and belong in your local area, rather than, say, for example, planting eucalypts from Western Australia or something like that.
From here, the next step is for farmers to work out what animals are using the plants that can help benefit their land.
That story from Emily Middleton. Di has texted in about my earlier story about koala habitat preservation program funding and has asked, will wind farms be blocked from removing or reducing koala trees? Well, Di, that funding is specifically to help local landholders to complete that work on their own properties. I don't think it would stop wind farms in general from removing koala trees, but if you want to complete that sort of work on your land and you're hosting, say, a wind farm or a solar farm, you would have to speak to Southern Queensland Landscapes if you're applying for that funding.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
When the remote Queensland town of Julia Creek started searching for a permanent doctor, the job's $600,000 pay packet went viral. They received 95 applications from across the world for that job, which involves looking after the town's 550 people. And the doctor who won the job is an Australian rural generalist who says she found out about the position not via the viral campaign, but over a beer with her brother on a cattle property. Maddie Nixon has this story.
Working as a GP in the small New South Wales town of Mudgee, Pip Bunting met her brother, a road train driver, for a drink. It was a meeting that would change the course of her career.
We're at home in my home community of Molong, where I grew up on a cattle station there, having a beer one afternoon out the front, and I said, I'm really looking for a new challenge now. And he said, what about Julia Creek? It's a great little place.
What she didn't know was that the job her brother had in mind had gone viral. It was for a GP to work in a remote community of just 550 with an annual salary of $600,000. Her brother had heard about it on ABC Radio. Pip decided to throw her hat into the ring, along with 94 other doctors from around the world.
This role came up and I thought, why not?
Now, she's the new GP in Julia Creek, about a three-hour drive east from Mount Isa. But it wasn't the money that lured her to this remote community.
I've been really lucky that I've had a really diverse kind of background that means that I've got some really, really diverse skills in sort of retrieval medicine, emergency medicine, anaesthetics, aged care, general practice. So this was kind of a role that gave me the opportunity to utilise all of that on a day-to-day basis, and that's really satisfying.
As the only doctor for at least 100 kilometres, Pip's role at the Julia Creek Multipurpose Health Centre covers general practice, emergency medicine and aged care medicine. She says there is no such thing as a typical workday.
Some days can be really busy and other days are kind of more of that controlled chaos situation, I guess. But we've got a really great team here that works really, really hard. And so even on our crazy, crazy busy days, it's been good because we've got a really good team. It's the people that make rural medicine really special.
She would love for more medical students who grew up as country kids like her to be encouraged to work remotely too.
Certainly coming from a rural background, we should try really, really hard to recruit kids that have grown up in that rural environment and appreciate how special that can be. I certainly think as you progress through medicine, the more training we can do in the country, the more likely people are to come back to rural and remote areas. Certainly the financial incentives help. And certainly, you know, obviously we'd love to attract people that have grown up in the city out to rural and remote areas. But I think by and large, if we can offer people great experiences whilst they're at school and through medical school, they're much more likely to come back to the communities.
For Pip, it's not just the work she's enjoying. She is also loving her new home in northwest Queensland.
I've had a great time. Communities like this are so special. This is a kind of community that really shows up for each other. You know, there's a lot of nurturing that goes on, a lot of support for each other in these communities.
That story by Maddie Nixon. That's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. My name is Megan Hughes. News is up next. It's 1 o'clock.